From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Floating format tonight for you. Two guests, 2 hours apiece tonight. Great program in store. Grocery chain Trader Joe's will stop selling food imported from China due to customers' concerns about the product's safety. Now, a series of consumer scares last year involving harmful products from the major exporter China, including seafood, cat food, medicines, toys, led to mass product recalls and the tightening of U.S. safety regulations. Trader Joe's, which focuses partly on selling organic food, was founded in California in the 1960s. Lake Mead, a source of water for millions of people in the southwestern United States, could go dry by 2021, according to a new study. The study concludes that natural forces such as evaporation, changes wrought by global warming, and the increasing demand from the booming Southwest population are creating a deficit from this part of the Colorado River system. Along with Lake Powell, which is on the border between Arizona and Utah, Lake Mead supplies roughly 8 million people in the cities of Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and San Diego, among others, with critical water supplies. The system is currently only at half capacity because of recent strings of dry years, according to the researchers. Yet they continue to keep building and building and building. Sweeps for Obama and McCain in the Potomac primaries. Barack Obama, John McCain swept those primaries, giving the candidates a vital injection of delegates in the race for their party's nominations. McCain beat Mike Huckabee in Maryland and the District of Columbia after starting out the night in a surprisingly close race in Virginia that he later opened up to a large win. And Obama, running away from Hillary Clinton, now leading with delegates, the momentum is shifting. The Senate has approved new rules for government eavesdropping on phone calls and emails, giving the White House much of the latitude it wanted in granting legal immunity to telecommunications companies that helped in the snooping after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. In Decatur, Georgia, police have arrested a man after the three-year-old boy he was watching apparently shot himself by accident. Joshua White was babysitting his girlfriend's three-year-old son. When this happened, the boy was shot above the eye, expected to survive. Just what happened? Nobody knows for sure. The company that makes the BlackBerry smartphones says it's still looking into what caused the second widespread service disruption in less than a year. Research in Motion said customers in the United States and Canada experienced intermittent delays for about 3 hours on Monday. Astronomers took pictures of a far-off, lumpy galaxy just forming 13 billion years ago, putting it among the earliest and most distant cosmic objects ever photographed. Though the black and white images are fuzzy, they are the most detailed and best confirmed look back in both time and distance that humans have seen. The galaxy is from when the universe was about 700 million years old. That's all, not long after the formation of the first galaxies. In a moment, Jacques Vallée joins us on Coast to Coast AM. His trilogy, the Alien Contact Trilogy, hailed as one of the best series of books on the UFO subject. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, now here he is. Jacques Vallée began his professional life as an astronomer at the Paris Observatory in 1961. While on the staff of the French Space Committee, he witnessed the destruction of tracking tapes of unknown objects orbiting the Earth, initiating a lifelong interest in the UFO phenomenon. Vallée arrived in the United States in 62, worked in the astronomy department at the University of Texas at Austin, and wrote two highly respected scientific examinations arguing for the extraterrestrial hypothesis, then of UFO origins. In 1967, he received a PhD in computer science from Northwestern University, became a very close associate of the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek, then the scientific consultant for the U.S. Air Force on Project Blue Book. If you remember the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the person who was the Frenchman in the movie, of course, depicted Dr. Jacques Vallée, and he is our guest for the next couple hours on Coast to Coast, and he's back. Hey, Jacques, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
Oh, always good to have you here on the program, my friend. Life is well. Life is well. I was just in Austin, Texas, a few weeks ago, by the way. It's a great city, Jacques.
It's changed quite a bit since 1962.
Oh, my gosh. It sure has. I fell in a hole when I was out there, and nobody came to come and pull me out of it. And I was splashed looking like Swamp Man. I looked like an extraterrestrial myself that day, Jacques. Now, you have been doing some tremendous work over the years in the UFO field, and you know, you've stopped, slowed down for a while, and you're coming back with a pretty good vengeance, which I like. People are beginning to notice you again. What's the reason for that?
Well, you know, Dr. Hynek used to quote the Chinese proverb: "There is a time to fish, and there is a time to mend your nets." And in science, you know, you go through phases of having a lot of data, being in the middle of a field that's very active, where you just don't have too much time to think and analyze. You're just too busy collecting data. And then in quiet periods, you can go back to the lab and, you know, close the door and try to make sense out of the patterns that emerge. And so that's what I try to do. I'm not chasing ambulances. I'm not especially interested in having another, you know, 100 or 1,000 reports. I'm really trying to, my contribution, if there is one, is going to be to try to come up with a methodology to look for patterns in all this.
And what I find fascinating, Jacques, because I've looked into the UFO issue for many years myself now, is that you're coming back in a bigger way at a moment where I think we who have been in this field for a long time need someone like you. I don't think I recall a time where more and more UFO reports have been coming, and they look so credible, they look so important, and I'm just glad that you're coming back into the field again.
Well, I never had any delusions about solving the problem, you know, by myself or with a small group. I've always thought that I had a responsibility because I've been in a position to receive valuable reports from people, from, you know, through my writing and through the places where I've worked and my association with the privilege of being associated with people like Alan Hynek and others. And my responsibility is to try to transmit this and to try to help people who come, you know, after us sort out the good data and not have to waste as much time as we've wasted trying to sift through all the irrelevant stuff, because, you know, 90% of all the data is explainable for all the usual reasons. And so we have to concentrate on the unexplainable, on the really puzzling data.
Sure. And then that 10% is very important. Just over the past several years now, we've seen some incredible cases, some incredible unexplained cases. You know, the episode at O'Hare Airport.
Yes.
That was one I want to talk with you about, the Stephenville, Texas sighting that just occurred as well. But is it my impression, do you feel the same way, that we are getting some very credible UFO reports lately?
Yes, we're getting fewer reports, possibly because the media if you take all the numbers, of course, on the internet, you've got thousands of things all the time, but that's really at the noise level. In terms of the well-documented reports, the media seems to be less interested these days in the subject. To their credit, they are, you know, distracted by other things.
Sure.
Like the elections. And the few cases that are being studied are very, very interesting indeed. And as you may know, the O'Hare sighting was analyzed by a group of scientists around Dr. Haynes, the NARCAP group that is doing a tremendous job of documenting aerial cases, and those have become a class by themselves. You know, the cases that over the years have been seen by pilots and airline officials and control tower operators, radar operators, Because here you have usually instrumented data and you have trained observers.
Well, and you know, the FAA comes out and talks about weather patterns and things like that at O'Hare, yet when you look at some of the pictures we've seen of clouds with donut holes punctured through them, and then the testimony of so many people, you begin to shake your head and you begin to wonder, how can they come up with excuses like that?
Well, the first tendency is to try to explain it away in parts, so they don't have to talk to journalists and they don't have to talk to the media, and they can go back to their normal life. And that's, I guess, it's a human tendency, especially since there is no rule or no regulation that says that those have to be reported anymore. Of course, in other times, a case like the one at O'Hare would have created, you know, a great deal of interest, both from the military and from the public. But the public seems to be pretty jaded these days, and that you know, this thing could sit there for probably about 10 minutes, from what I've heard, right over Concorde C at O'Hare Airport in the late afternoon, and very, very few people have really asked the right questions about it.
In Britain, not too long ago, pilots witnessed seeing a huge objects. One pilot quoted as saying, don't know what it is. I don't know if it's extraterrestrial, but I'll tell you this, I've never seen anything like this before. And we're getting more and more of this, like the Stephenville, Texas sighting, of course, too. So many witnesses seeing this huge 3 football field long object again. Is it possible with all these recent sightings, Jacques, that we might be looking at the same object or the same craft, whatever it might be?
It seems to be, there was a time, I guess, in the 70s and 80s when we being the ufology community, the people who were trying to make some sense out of all this, thought that there were clear patterns of objects in terms of size and shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. That seems to have broken down, and my colleagues may disagree with me on that, but we have more and more reports of large triangles, more and more reports of very, very large objects like the one that you mentioned over England. Actually, it wasn't over England, it was over the channel between England and France. So the English are saying, they are telling the French, why don't you investigate it? It's not one of ours. And the French are saying, well, maybe it's English, So, but that's usual, bureaucratic behavior. But we seem to have a wide variety of shapes and patterns of objects.
Do you believe that the United States or some government on this planet is capable of building and keeping it secret, an object, a craft that big, and getting it up there and letting it travel at these apparent speeds?
As you know, professionally, I follow technology, and my business is really
as a venture capitalist
investing in high technology, usually as the first money. So we see a lot of very creative, ambitious new things. Today, technology can do amazing things, and there are things flying. If you look at how many countries are building drones, for example, that go from the size of a fleet to the size of a fairly sizable aircraft. And some of them have extraordinary shapes. So, yes, something could be built and probably is being built that people are reporting in good faith as a UFO. That does not explain the phenomenon going back 50 years or more, and it certainly does not explain the speeds. I mean, you still have to follow the usual rules of aerodynamics if you're going to build something like this. To my knowledge, those rules have not, those laws of physics have not been repealed yet. So UFOs the unexplained cases that people are reporting have to do with something else. Also, if we had that technology, then, you know, why are we still flying B-52s, you know, over Afghanistan?
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about this Stephenville, Texas sighting. Have you had an opportunity to look into this one, Jacques?
I have not. I'm concentrating on just a few cases at a time, and I like to go back and work on old cases. I know a number of people have looked at the Stephenville case, and I have not done a special study of it.
When you put together the Alien Contact trilogy the second volume, Confrontations, you looked at some incredible UFO cases. Was there one that really stood out for you?
There is a series of cases in Brazil that still, that's the one thing that I come back to again and again and again. My wife and I had we went to Brazil 3 times to meet with people there and to study cases there fairly quietly. But the third time we were in the area around Belém, between Belém and Manaus, at the mouth of the Amazon, and in 1977 there was a wave of sightings in that whole region, and it's not the jungle there. It's not what you imagine the Amazon to be in the deep jungle. It's more it's a very rural area, but you can walk through it, and there are farms and ranches and so on. And there are a number of islands in the Amazon River itself. Over a period of 3 years, in the fall of 77, there were observations every day, every night, actually, of objects, some small objects, some large objects dropping from the sky, some coming out of the water, and flying at low level over the villages there and over the beaches. The people were terrified. They were terrified in part because these objects had beams that seemed to cause harm to the people who were hit by those beams. So all the people who could leave those islands, the island of Mosquero and the island of Colares especially, went back to the mainland. They went back to Belém, which is a large city on the south shore of the Amazon. And very few people were left there. The people who were left there included a medical doctor that we spoke to, and included some of the witnesses. They saw the objects, but they also photographed them, and they also saw a team of Air Force intelligence, about 60 people, who came and camped on those beaches, and they had cameras, they had film cameras, and they started observing those things night after night after night. Now, here we have the witnesses, and you have the ideal situation.
Sure.
You have a wave of unexplained cases, and the witnesses are 60 intelligence officers from the Brazilian Air Force. I had a chance to spend a day with the man who was the head of that task force. And this was, of course, over 10 years later. And actually, the Brazilians who were with us were amazed that we were invited inside the Air Force base and spent a day with this man and his staff. But they went over what they had seen. There were 3 levels of reports they had written. They only shared the first level, which was confidential, but was something that they could share. The other two were classified, and they could not share them. In fact, they didn't have access to them anymore. And those cases, these men were not kidding. I mean, they were still talking about it as something that was very, very powerful, somewhat terrifying, and completely unexplained.
An incredible effect on them, no doubt.
Yes. Now, these are intelligence officers. The man who was head of that task force was from the Amazon basin. His mother was of Indian descent. He spoke the languages of the Amazon, of the Amazon Indians. The area that they covered was called Primeiro Comar, and that's an area the size of, slightly larger than Texas. And they know those areas very well. They know the local population very well, and they obviously know everything that flies.
Yet it continues to happen time and time again. Stay with us. Dr. Jacques Vallée, our guest for the next hour and a half. I'm George Norrie, and this, of course, is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. With our special guest, we've got two tonight in our floating format, Jacques Vallée. And we'll be back with Jacques in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jacques, I never had an opportunity to talk with you about the 1947 Roswell case. Did you ever look into that, and what's your take on that?
You're posing this as a very innocuous and innocent question. You know, you're opening, a very large area. I have followed. I have a lot of respect for Mr. Friedman, for Stanton Friedman. Mm-hmm. I followed his research, and I respect it. He's one of the people in the field who actually, do their homework and do it carefully. I've read the testimonies that have been assembled. I think most people don't realize that for many, many years, Roswell was just not mentioned in the context of UFO research.
Right.
It's really in the 80s that it became an item of interest for people. Before then, there were lots of cases in 1947 that were more interesting to people, and there were all these rumors about crashed things, but you could never pin them down. You could never really, the witnesses never wanted to be mentioned, and so on. Roswell then emerged, and there was suddenly a lot of publicity about it, and it became a cause célèbre, if you allow me to slip into French. I have a problem with making Roswell such a prominent case, because then the whole in the discussion between about the phenomenon with skeptics,
right.
The skeptics will say, well, guys, give us one case. I mean, you have too many cases. Give us your best case, and we'll investigate it. And then the ufologists say, well, Roswell. And but in Roswell, we actually have nothing that a scientist can take back into his lab. We have testimony from apparently honest, people who are remembering something that happened many years
right.
ago. The testimony, when you look at the different books and the different studies, is very confusing and contradictory. The description of what, and again, there is no question that something fell from the sky in Roswell.
No doubt, right? No doubt.
There is no question something fell from the sky. There is no question that, item number two, fact number two, the army or the military came in and picked up every piece of it, and then they lied about what it was. I mean, those are three facts. So on the basis of that, it's tempting to jump to the conclusion that, well, this must have been a UFO, okay? Well, it could have been, or it could have been something else. And when you put it in the context of everything else that was going on in the Roswell area at the time, remember, this was the only base in the world that had atom bombs. This was also an area where a lot of research was going on, including medical research that has never really been documented very well. Some of which remains classified, including medical research, which, as several authors have pointed out, may have violated some of the standards of human subject research. There could have been a lot of reasons for throwing a veil of secrecy over what was actually going on there. The explanations that have been given are not very convincing. You know, the Air Force has said, well, it was a balloon. Actually, what's being described, it looks like a balloon. Mm-hmm. It looks like a reflecting surface of some kind, some advanced material, but not advanced by our standards. Certainly interesting material by the standards of 1947, but you know, something that looked like was very light material, like balsa wood with hieroglyphics on it. Well, many people have pointed out there were such things used to as the armature of balloons that were classified at the time, that were designed to pick up different you know, radiation levels in the higher atmosphere and so on, that were classified. So there is a mix of puzzling facts and explanations that are not complete explanations, and you end up with something where the, you know, a scientist with an open mind is going to say, look, you know, you're not giving me anything that I can really work on. There are so many other UFO cases where we have data, where we have maybe not hardware in the, you know, the kind of hardware we would like to have, but we certainly have metal that has been left behind in connection with reliable descriptions by witnesses that we can interview today. You know, and as you know, I mean, in Confrontations, in the second book of the trilogy, I have an entire chapter on looking for patterns in that material, some of which I own. So, you know, there is material, there is metal residue that is puzzling. It's not something that would be unexplainable in terms of Earth chemistry, but it's very, very strange.
Would it have been difficult to explain in terms of Earth chemistry based on the fact that it was 1947?
No.
It would not? Okay.
No.
Okay. You know, one of the things, though, Jacques, that astounds me about Roswell is this deathbed signed affidavit by Lieutenant Walter Haut, who originally put out the news release that the Army Air Force had found this wreckage and had it, and then he changed the story. He said he was told to change it. But when he died, he left this document that claims that he saw the crashed wreckage. And I find that to be pretty compelling. Of everything that I've heard about Roswell, the Walter Haut deathbed confession seems to be pretty fascinating to me.
It's all fascinating. I've spent time with Colonel Corso. I've spent time with other people who had been hired to investigate events around Roswell. It is fascinating, but it is not the best case on which to base an argument about the reality of UFOs.
With Alien Contact Trilogy, in the three books, Dimensions, Confrontations, and Revelations, Revelations seem to have changed. It went from the first tour, they went from cases and historical records to this one seemed to be darker, that there seemed to be some kind of danger involved in this field. Now, that's my impression. You wrote it.
Your impression is correct. Actually, I stopped the writing twice. I gave up on the book twice because I was somewhat repelled by the material. And the material had to do, well, the first volume is Dimensions, and it's really an overview of the history of the phenomenon, putting it in historical perspective and bringing it to the present. Confrontations is really the most important book from my point of view. It's people always say, why don't scientists go into the field and investigate those things?
Right.
Well, that's what we did, okay? My wife and I and a small team of friends and colleagues, and Confrontations is really the summary of about 10 years of research. Most of practically all the cases are first-hand cases investigated at the site. It's not armchair research. You know, we went there, we found the witnesses, we spoke to them, and we inspected the site. And we, in many cases, we analyzed what was there. Then I couldn't leave it there because the story is bigger than that.
The
story includes belief systems, it includes cults, it includes contactees, it includes people with extreme beliefs who have contributed to creating what the public thinks of today as the UFO phenomenon. You know, that includes, for example, the HIM group that became Heaven's Gate. In a prior book in 1975, mm-hmm. I had, actually, 79, called Messengers of Deception, I had warned people about not joining those groups. I attended a meeting of that group, and I mention it again in Revelations, a meeting of that group at Stanford, where one of the students who listened to the presentation by those by the members of the cult asked what's the risk in joining you, and the answer was you only risk your life.
Yeah, exactly.
And that people don't want to hear that. The book was at the time was and that warning was rejected by most of the UFO believers or researchers as something that was irrelevant. These are crazy people with their own little crazy beliefs, and that's not relevant to what we do. Well, it is relevant because it's shaping our perceptions of it, and of course we've seen that later in the mass suicide of the members of Heaven's Gate. It's important to study those groups, and I'm not a sociologist, so I can only go so far in calling attention to that aspect of the problem. And then you have another panel, so to speak, that's even more confusing, which is the intervention of intelligence services. And when you spend a lot of time in the field talking to witnesses about what they've seen, after a while you become aware that there is more than just natural phenomena and things that could be UFOs, but there are also people playing games. Now, some of those games may be played, maybe psychological warfare exercises. There may be very legitimate from the point of view of the military or the training of special forces. And well, to give you an example, because people are going to say, well, it's all speculation. Mm-hmm, well, sure. Let me tell you something that's not speculation. I have a friend, actually, a colleague in venture capital, who used to be in the special forces. And one of the things that they did, and this was back in the 70s and 80s, was to attempt penetration of nuclear sites, American nuclear sites. They would drop from the sky at night with out of devices that were made to look like flying saucers. Now, if you're a guard at a missile base and you're told to shoot at any helicopter that comes over the fence, if a helicopter comes over the fence, you're going to shoot at it. If a flying saucer comes over the fence, or the Virgin Mary comes over the fence, what do you do with your machine gun? And there are exercises like that.
Right.
That may explain why there are strange things seen around missile sites or nuclear sites. Attempting penetration, for the sake of security of those sites is very important. And people do some pretty weird things. And to some extent, when you really look into it and you talk to people like that, you begin to see that some of that is legitimate. But it's very confusing. And it's going to be very confusing to somebody who just happens to be there and watch this and not know what's going on. So I thought I had to document some of those cases, and some of the prominent UFO cases of the 70s and 80s and 90s, in my opinion, are just such exercises.
Dr. David Jacobs believes also that there's a dark side to the ufology field, that whatever this mission is of whatever these may be, he believes that it's not on friendly terms here. Do you somewhat agree with that?
Well, I've discussed it with Dr. Jacobs. we may have come to similar feelings from different directions.
Right.
My feeling about the fact that those things are not necessarily friendly, you know, assuming there is a form of consciousness associated with it, comes from what happened in Brazil, for example, where definitely there was hostile behavior. It was hostile behavior, but it wasn't, those things were not really displayed as weapons. I mean, they could have, you know, they could have done much more harm if what we think about the technology is correct. At the same time, what Dr. Jacobs and Bud Hopkins have done is derived from hypnosis of abduction victims.
Right.
And as you may know, I have a big problem with hypnosis. I don't think hypnosis is the right way to analyze those cases.
Yeah, you don't believe it extracts the right information.
Well, I'm no expert in that, but I read what experts have written, and I've consulted with a number of psychiatrists and psychologists, clinical psychologists, and people who teach hypnosis to clinical psychologists. They all tell me the same thing, that if you are in front of a person who believes that they've had an experience which is so traumatic, the last thing you should do is use hypnosis. There are other ways of extracting information that are much more gentle and more reliable. Furthermore, hypnosis, you know, has been looked at as a method for extracting the truth in court, and there is a very large literature about the excesses, you know, and the mistakes made with hypnosis, especially in the hands of untrained people. And so I don't think we can rely on that material.
Jacques, we know something is happening. What we don't know is who and why and where necessarily. But there's so many different theories, that they're time travelers from our own planet, that they might be dimensional, that they're truly extraterrestrial from other planetary systems. Have you come to any specific conclusions as to what you think is going on?
No, I really haven't, and I think we shouldn't try to come up with conclusions at this point. You know, it's true that it's very confusing, and there is all that data, but we have a way of addressing that, and it's called science, and the science has never been done.
No, it hasn't caught up with us at all.
People like, Dr. James McDonald, Dr. Hynek, and myself, and Dr. Haynes, and a number of other people, Dr. Poher in France, and so on, have studied this with our training as scientists, but we haven't done science. I mean, that's not the way you do science. The way you do science is you fund a number of teams in competition with each other. You call for proposals for research with a particular goal, usually a limited goal. You don't try to solve the whole problem at once. You try to go for chunks of it. You develop databases that are reliable, and then you do that step by step. And that's how, you know, that's how the internet was built. That's how cancer research is done. That's how science progresses. It has never been done. So how can we even hazard hypotheses? I mean, sure, we can speculate, you know, certainly in science fiction, which is something I love. We've got lots of ideas on what those things could be, but that we have no way of backing up any of that. So it becomes a battle of beliefs.
Jacques, we're at the top of the hour. We've got one more hour to go with you, and one of the things we'll do is open up the phone lines and let everybody have an opportunity to talk to truly one of the wonders of the world when it comes to the field of ufology, Dr. Jacques Vallée. His websites, there are many there. They're all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, we'll talk more about perhaps the Billy Meyer case in Switzerland. I'd like to get Dr. Vallée's take on that and your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM.